Hey y'all, how's it going? Oh, well, good, good. Happy to hear it. Oh, I see what's wrong. Better? No? Huh. I don't know. Very strange. All right, well. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. It'll be a good one for you today. Michael Meharry from the 10th Amendment Center is going to be on here to talk about a major step forward. I don't know if you could call it quite a victory yet, but a major step forward for the Off Now, Nullify the NSA movement. And, you know, you may have seen that pessimistic piece that ran at LouRockwell.com and a couple other places about Edward Snowden's revelations helping the NSA, sort of revealing the American people as apathetic and that their acquiescence amounts to, or their apathy amounts to acquiescence, a ratification, a post hoc ratification of the program. And I don't think that's true. I think it's only true that the American people know that Congress doesn't represent them. Congress represents, one, the state itself, and two, the state's cronies. And that excludes 99% of us. So just because people know better than to think that they can control Congress doesn't mean that they don't care. And I think people do care, and I think when you give them an opportunity to actually do something about it where they feel like they can have an effect, you find that apathy wash right away. And that's what the Off Now Project is all about. Is, you know, democracy is a pain in the ass and everything. And honestly, you know, I'm a Spoonerite on and a Rothbardian on this kind of thing. I don't believe in the legitimacy of the state at all, democracy at all. However, if you have some liberty, democracy could be useful as a way to prevent the worst erosions of it, you know, the worst excesses against it, if you try hard. And the more local the power, the more effect you could possibly have. You know, all things being equal, it could be that, you know, Verizon is based in your state and they own the governor and the lieutenant governor lock, stock, and barrel, and you're never going to get anywhere there. I don't know. But I'm just saying, regular people have a lot better shot at controlling the outcomes at a local level than at the federal level. Again, all things being equal there. So, they're proving it at the 10th Amendment Center. They've got this movement. They're saying, listen, and this is how all American politics should be anyway. They're saying, let's nullify what the national government is doing from the ground up, from the bottom up, from the local and state level up. And we'll get as many different jurisdictions refusing to participate as possible. And then we'll make some real headway. And then we'll make some real headway with the American people, with the opinions of the people of this country, too. That, no, really, I don't care what TV says. The real consensus is this is wrong and we're against it. And then we'll win. That's the thing. It's very clumsy. I'm not even sure if it's up there yet. But I made up a new bumper sticker because, you know, I like making up bumper stickers. I used to be a cab driver. I used to do all my best thinking in the context of what I wish I could tell everybody that I don't have a chance to tell them, you know? What point would I try to bring up at least to get them to think about it? So my new bumper sticker says, look, if this whole NSA thing was really a big deal, then all your favorite TV characters would be concerned, right? So don't worry. Which is kind of ridiculous and stupid and extremely wordy for a bumper sticker. But, you know, I'm trying to, you know, give you an opportunity to confront that way of thinking. Because that is, look, I mean, come on. You know as well as I do that that's how it is, man. That's where people get they pick up the context clues from their sitcoms of what it is that they're supposed to be interested in, what it is that they're supposed to care about. Same thing with their musicians. the people that they look up to in other aspects of life. It's all about impressions, not facts. It's all about, you know, what do the people that you would like to accept you think? Well, all the people that you would like to accept you are pro-war. Kill them all. Okay, so now you're a warmonger. Or all the people that you would like to accept you are all anti-war. And so now, oh, now you're anti-war. That's how people are. I mean, you might have some solid principles that you refuse to bend on or whatever, but that makes you more or less unique. And it still doesn't make you different than anybody else, just maybe on some particular issues. But, you know, why the hell are people all environmentalists in America? Because TV has this consensus that says that's a good thing to be. All your favorite characters on your sitcoms, they all are very concerned about recycling and stuff. Sometimes they'll even have like a very special episode of Webster about the importance of recycling. I'm sorry, I don't know. What's the one where they're all science kids or something that everybody seems to like so much? It's got the boyfriend from Roseanne in it, I know that. Well, if those guys all absolutely hated the NSA and loved the Bill of Rights and had a bunch of jokes to crack about how horrible all anti-Bill of Rights people are, then they could change the world, right? Big Bang Theory. Thank you, chat room saving my ass here. Big Bang Theory. The guys on the Big Bang Theory, if they hated the NSA, GD, NSA, violating my rights all the time, why all science nerd sitcom people like us ought to do everything we can to develop new encryptment technologies in order to thwart them, then that would be the consensus in the society. That's what it takes. And I sort of, you know, I'm just trying to inoculate your attitude from those kind of things by putting it in such blatant and stupid language on a bumper sticker that, geez, you know, really, it shouldn't matter what my sitcom friends think at all. My sitcom friends might not have ever heard of the war on terrorism at all. My sitcom friends might live in a world where there's nothing that exists outside the America, or maybe the occasional reference to Europe or Japan or something. But maybe I need to care about the war anyway. If only there was a way that I could feed you guys popcorn and jelly beans. Well, I guess I could feed you popcorn-flavored jelly beans if you like those. Or popcorn or jelly beans. As I learned in social psychology class, if I was to try to recruit you to be an environmental commie or a John Birch one world government nut, I would do 75% better either way if I was to feed you popcorn while I show you the promotional video. And you know, I said that to Eric Garris once. It's not really science, right? It's social science, which means they do the same damn experiment a million times. And yeah, no, really. People will join up your environmental movement in much higher rates if you feed them popcorn. It's just like that. And I told Eric Garris that once. And Eric Garris, he's been a libertarian for a long, long time. And he once interviewed, or I guess helped to interview, or interview. He was part of an interview of Ronald Reagan in the 1970s for Reason magazine. And I told Eric Garris the jelly bean popcorn gag, and he said to me, when I first met Ronald Reagan, I just thought he was great. He was just the nicest guy and greatest guy, and you know what he did? The moment I walked in the room, he fed me jelly beans. He fed me jelly beans. There you go. Oh, number six says, if they hated the NSA, they would lose their grant money. Ah, touche. That's why they call it the warfare welfare state. And that goes for all you scientists, too. Just about. Anyway, boy, I get off on my tangents, don't I? I'm just trying to help. Look, if this whole NSA thing was really a big deal, then all your favorite TV characters would be concerned, right? I should say forget about it, so forget about it. Nah, because that sounds too like I'm trying to say it in an Italian way or whatever. Just... so, don't worry. You know, Walter Pincus wrote a thing for the Washington Post, says, all this hubbub about the NSA, and unlike the Nixon era, you can't point to one person who's had their rights violated. Dude, Walter Pincus, what are you talking about, old man? it's time to retire, sir, all due respect. You know, I kind of like Walter Pincus because he's a former intelligence guy who admits it. It's not like he's a secret, you know, Operation Mockingbird type. He's very close to intelligence agencies, and therefore he gets things right sometimes. He wrote very important stuff about the White House Iraq group, for example, that helped lie us into war and all of that. And quite a number of other stories. But, yeah, no, Walter, the news is that all of us have had our rights violated. All of us. And especially you, Mr. Journalist. Man, Walter Pincus. Old coot. He's an old man. You know, look the other way. It's not like he was ever a good guy, really, a libertarian or anything. Just, you know, did decent journalism sometimes, that's all. Just not this time. Crap. Oh, yeah. Also, John Pfeffer's going to be here. I told you yesterday, Pfeffer's going to be on the show today, and it's going to be to talk about the next re-rise of the War Party after the end of the Obama years. Not that they've really been taking a lot of time off or anything. The three-front war doctrine with John Pfeffer coming up on the show. And when we get back, I'll tell you about good old Dr. Gabriel Kolko, who has died at the ripe old age of 81 or 82, depending on who you believe. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. I swear to God, man, if it's not one thing, it's another with this damn setup. I know what it's got to be. I just need someone else in here to look at my levels for me while I fix it. And I can't do that because there ain't nobody to do that. Well, huh. Yeah, no, that makes sense, though. I'll tell you what, I may be able to fix it during the next break. I just got too many damn pieces of equipment in this chain. And it's all slapped together. Ghetto radio studio here, man. Anyway. Yeah, and the damn clock is wrong, too. Good. How about now? I sound okay. Am I out of balance, too, chat room? Check, check, check. Check, check, check. Coming up next, Aerosmith again. Again. No, I'm just kidding. I wouldn't play that on this show. That was my radio voice. That was my KLBJ voice. Coming up next, Sweet Emotion by Aerosmith for the 170 millionth time. Happy suicide. Rest in peace. Is that out of balance or that's in balance? Two for Tuesday. Okay, I'm good. Yeah, coming up next, a double shot of Aerosmith. First, Ragdoll, which you might be able to stand for a second, and then Sweet Emotion again, which you're going to love. Okay, no Aerosmith. I may play some more Motorhead, but I'll try to get it back in balance for you. All right. So listen, goddammit, Gabriel Kolko died, and I guess I shouldn't cuss about it because, you know, he was 81 or 82 years old, and these things happen. But I really like Gabriel Kolko. I interviewed him a few times, three times, about the empire, about Palestine, and I forget what all book of his I read. I don't think I ever did interview him about the triumph of conservatism, which is his real claim to fame among libertarians anyway. Now, here's the deal about Gabriel Kolko. He was just died in Amsterdam yesterday there at 81 or 82 or so. And but the reason he's very important to libertarians and has been for many years now is because of this book he wrote back in 1975 called The Triumph of Conservatism, A Reinterpretation of American History, 1900 through 1916. I might add why every person on the left, liberal, progressive, leftist, commie, anarchist of any stripe, any kind of liberal, any kind of leftist ought to be a libertarian, ought to abandon statism completely and be a libertarian. Because Gabriel Kolko from the William Appleton Williams leftist revisionist school of historians, in this book, The Triumph of Conservatism, A Reinterpretation of American History, 1900 through 1916, makes the case that the progressive era was not really progressive at all. It was not really led by bottom-up liberal and populist reformers. It was led by big business. Hence the title, The Triumph of Conservatism. And now, if you ever listen to the show or follow me on Twitter or anything, you know, I'm always constantly trying to recommend to people that they read this great Rothbard essay called Left and Right, The Prospects for Liberty. And in that essay, Rothbard sort of caricatures, well, not really caricatures, like in an unfair way, but he kind of encapsulate this sort of right-wing narrative that America was this free market, you know, laissez-faire paradise. And this is, of course, it's sort of the funny, the funhouse image version of the liberal story as well. That America had a free economy until the New Deal. And then the New Deal, led by Commie Roosevelt, with influenced by Felix Frankfurter, the Intercollegiate Socialist Society, and other Fabian and communist conspirators, engineered a revolution which set America on the path to socialism, and et cetera, like that. And then so Rothbard says, yeah, but anybody who's a libertarian ought to be able to see right through this. For one thing, the income tax and the central bank, well, no, I guess not the central bank. The income tax came through William Howard Taft. Now, if you're telling me, he says no one would say that William Howard Taft was a leftist. And he says, well, here, let me read a little bit of Rothbard here. One would think a right-wing libertarian would quickly be able to see some drastic flaws in this conception. For one thing, the income tax amendment, which he deplores as the beginning of socialism in America, was put through Congress in 1909 by an overwhelming majority of both parties. To look at this event as a sharp leftward move towards socialism would require treating President William Howard Taft, who put through the 16th Amendment, as a leftist. And surely few would have the temerity to do that. Indeed, the New Deal was not a revolution in any sense. Its entire collectivist program was anticipated, proximately by Herbert Hoover during the Depression, and see Rothbard's America's Great Depression for more on that, and beyond that by the war collectivism and central planning that governed America during the First World War. Every element in the New Deal program, central planning, creation of a network of compulsory cartels for industry and agriculture, inflation and credit expansion, artificial raising of wage rates, and the promotion of unions within the overall monopoly structure, government regulation and ownership, all this had been anticipated and adumbrated during the previous two decades. And this program, with its privileges, oh, pardon me, with its privileging of various big business interests at the top of the collectivist heap, was in no sense reminiscent of socialism or leftism. There was nothing smacking, and this is Rothbard speaking, by the way. So if you're right when you're objecting, hush. There was nothing smacking of the egalitarian or the proletarian here. No, the kinship of this burgeoning collectivism was not at all with socialism, communism, but with fascism, or socialism of the right, a kinship of which many big businessmen of the 20s expressed openly in their yearning for abandonment of a quasi-laissez-faire system for a collectivism which they could control. And surely, William Howard Taft, Woodrow Wilson, and Herbert Clark Hoover make far more recognizable figures as proto-fascists than they do as crypto-communists. And then he goes on, skip a few here, and get to Rothbard's quoting of Gabriel Kolko. And this is from, again, Left and Right, The Prospects for Liberty. Or he's quoting now the late Gabriel Kolko, Murray Rothbard, quoting Gabriel Kolko, who just died yesterday. The most thorough exposition of the origins of state monopoly capitalism, or what he calls political capitalism, in the U.S., is found in the brilliant work of Dr. Gabriel Kolko. In his Triumph of Conservatism, Kolko traces the origins of political capitalism in the reforms of the Progressive Era. Orthodox historians have always treated the Progressive Period, roughly 1900 through 16, as a time when free market capitalism was becoming increasingly monopolistic. In reaction to this reign of monopoly in big business, so the story runs, altruistic intellectuals and far-seeing politicians turned to intervention by the government to reform and regulate these evils. Kolko's great work demonstrates that the reality was almost precisely the opposite of this myth. Despite the wave of mergers and trusts formed around the turn of the century, Kolko reveals the forces of competition on the free market rapidly vitiated and dissolved these attempts at stabilizing and perpetuating the economic power of big business interests. It was precisely in reaction to their impending defeat at the hands of the competitive storms of the market that business turned, increasingly after the 1900s, to the federal government for aid and protection. In short, the intervention by the federal government was designed not to curb big business monopoly for the sake of the public weal, but to create monopolies that big business, as well as trade associations and smaller business, had not been able to establish amidst the competitive gales of the free market. And now, of course, Kolko agreed with the big businessmen that capitalism was irrational, but certainly disagreed with how they solved the problem. But you could see why a free market type like Rothbard celebrates Kolko's work so highly. Today's show is brought to you in part by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/Scott. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For Scott Horton Show listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with their free 30-day trial. I personally recommend Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. It's great for anyone wanting the inside story on the cruel and counterproductive terror war of the Obama years. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial and download Dirty Wars at no charge by going to audibletrial.com/Scott. That's audibletrial.com/Scott. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right. Well, I hope the levels are a little bit better, y'all. And let me update the damn time here, too. My time's off. All right. Assuming the government's clock is correct, my clock should be okay now. Hell, I don't know. Well, I was hoping to hear from Patrick Coburn. Still might about the stuff going on in Libya. Let me wrap up here and say a couple more things about Gabriel Kolko. Kolko was a leftist. His last book, I believe it was his last book, was called After Socialism, and it's one of those that I have but haven't gotten a chance to read yet. But anyway, he was over socialism. He is quoted at Reason in their obit by Jesse Walker there as saying that after Stalin and Mao and Blair, socialism is dead forever. Hallelujah. But he was no libertarian, and he didn't mean to encourage us and argue that what we needed was laissez-faire, free market, this or that. I think his argument, as quoted there at Reason, was that there's no such thing as a free market, nor would there ever be, and nor would he favor one. However, we still can learn a lot from him. I would argue, you know, when he actually, in the Triumph of Conservatism, he accepts the argument of the big businessmen, the conservatives, that markets are just irrational for coming up with prices. The prices do this, they do that. It's crazy. And so it doesn't make any sense to leave the people subject to this invisible hand of a madman God, you know? But the problem is that that wasn't really right. The problem is, as Murray Rothbard explains here, is that the gigantic conglomerates that the big businessmen were trying to create at the turn of the last century, the free market kept kicking their ass. And kept, basically, the market was demanding, spin off your companies. You need to be smaller and more nimble in these ways to be able to continue to compete. Maybe in one case, maybe for even one metal, an economy of scale and, a gigantic conglomerate makes sense. But in the case of another metal, not so much, for whatever market reasons. Whoever needs the metal and how far they are away from each other or who knows what. And only the free market and its pricing system can sort those things out. And so we can certainly see why big businessmen would be very upset if the free market kept kicking their ass and trying to bring them back down to size. But that should have been just their tough luck. Unfortunately, they were able to turn to the state, and especially they were able to convince the little guy that this was the state sticking it to big business and coming to their defense. And of course, the myth of all of that, especially in the form of the New Deal, holds to this day. Murray Rothbard is absolutely, I mean, and really all you got to do is just think about a little bit what you already know about the way that they teach you in school that, well, you know, FDR had to destroy capitalism to save it and all that. There would have been a communist revolution if he hadn't destroyed capitalism halfway or whatever. Well, what does that tell you? And it tells you that he had a deal with big business to make some changes and to spin them. And in fact, if you read the great Burton Folsom in his book, New Deal or Raw Deal, you'll see that all the government handouts and all the, you know, so-called experimenting in the economy and trying to save her, it was all just political patronage. It was all just buying up Democratic votes. That's all it was. Let's go back and look at who was getting paid what. It was all just payoffs. And anyway, so yeah, America is a fascist country, not a socialist one. Again, back to the president and the current crop of crap that you're supposed to believe about him. That he's some Afro-sporting Black Panther leftist Marxist revolutionary. Well, for a commie, he sure doesn't seem to care very much about poor people, does he? When, in fact, if you just look at his record, instead of through your skin color tainted glasses, you'll see that he's really a conservative centrist corporatist American imperialist. He's Herbert Hoover. He's Hillary Clinton. That's all he is. He's Wall Street's guy. Who was his number one donor? Goldman Sachs. That's how he became the president in the first place. Yeah, Goldman Sachs. They're a bunch of hardcore communists who want the people to seize all of their assets from them, huh? No. They're all fascists. The liberals and the conservatives in America, they're fascists. And their economic system, it's fascism. And what do you call mercantilism in a never-ending state of war with 2 million people in prison and every aspect of the economy regulated from the very bottom to the very top? It's a fascist state. It's a quasi-free market. A mixed economy. Soaked in the blood of innocence. Fascism. That's what it is. And so, there's Rothbard citing Colco, explaining how it all worked. You know, what's the point? If you're the conservatives, and you got all the money, and you control the state, and you've got all this pressure from below against you, what's the point in just being the right and trying to withstand all the pressure? Co-opt them. Buy them up. Simple. And that's what they did, starting more than 100 years ago. More like 130. And so, oh, you want a bunch of reforms and a bunch of regulations and this and that, huh? Well, don't throw me in the briar patch, dude. Oh, no, you want to regulate my railroad? Please don't regulate my railroad, cried the railroad men. Oh, you want to nationalize banking? Oh, no, please don't pass the Federal Reserve Act. You know, I had a conversation with Robert Higgs not long ago at the Students for Liberty conference, where he said really the myth of Jekyll Island is inaccurate. That the agreement that they attempted to hammer out at Jekyll Island in 1910, that's not really the origin of the Federal Reserve, only in a sort of kind of way. Really, there were different groups of bankers all around the country having meetings for years, all of them coming to a consensus that what they want is to have, regional banks, lenders of last resort. And, old man Morgan can't bail out everybody forever, but somebody's got to bail us out. Somehow the taxpayers got to bail us out. And so basically every banker in America was a conspirator in creating the Federal Reserve System at the expense of the rest of us. As Tom Wood says, it wasn't some publicly public-spirited left-wing professor who wrote the Federal Reserve Act. It was a bunch of bankers looking to get on your dole. I know, you're broke and they're bankers and they're on your welfare. Doesn't that sound kind of unfair to you? I know, exactly. Yeah. See? They're fascists. They're parasites and you're the mammal. So that's, yeah, there you get it. Anyway, I also want to say this about, the book is The Triumph of Conservatism, that's by Gabriel Kolko, and the Rothbard essay, among a few others, but most importantly, go read Left and Right, The Prospects for Liberty. And if you're a left-winger or right-winger of any description, I promise that'll change your life. And if you're a libertarian, then you'll just be extra smart. Read Left and Right, The Prospects for Liberty by Murray Rothbard there. All right, now, so here's the other thing, is Gabriel Kolko was a heroic historian of the warfare state and extremely biased against it, thank God. Anatomy of a War, Vietnam, the United States, and the Modern Historical Experience. The Age of War, the United States Confronts the World. World in Crisis, the End of the American Century. Another Century of War, Confronting the Third World. This one is more an economic thing. Wealth and Power in America, Railroads and Regulation. Oh, see, Amazon doesn't have them all in order. It should be Century of War and then Another Century of War. After Socialism, I mentioned Vietnam, Anatomy of a Peace, The Roots of American Foreign Policy, and Analysis of Power and Purpose. The Politics of War. Listen to this. Isn't this interesting? The Politics of War, The World and United States Foreign Policy, 1943 through 45. Huh. Interesting. An entire book-length study of American foreign policy just right there, stuck in the middle of World War II. 43 through 45. Through the middle of American intervention in World War II, anyway. There are more essays and things here listed. Oh, The Limits of Power is another one. The Roots of American Foreign Policy. Lessons from a Total Defeat. Vietnam 30 Years Later. Oh, that was an article. Still. He had a great archive at antiwar.com. He had a great archive at counterpunch.org. And he was a great historian and a great part of American culture and society. And he served a very important place. And he'll just look at Amazon.com. There's the proof. He'll live forever. The great Gabriel Kolko. Friend of the show. Rest in peace. All right. More bad news on the other side of this break. ScottHorton.org. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage, a great system, and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for OffNow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I screwed up. I was supposed to have John Pfeffer on last segment, and now I'm going to try to get him on next segment. It'll probably work out. All right, so I'll say here real quick that you may have seen that there's a dispute now between Greenwald and Assange. I only bring this up because it matters, not for, like, personality gossip sake or whatever, but it's a substantive issue here. The thing of it is that that first look piece that came out yesterday, the whatever, some kind of Pirates of the Caribbean, digital pirates or something, Glenn Greenwald's piece at First Look about how they're intercepting and recording every phone call in the Bahamas. All of them. And just for a test. Mostly. Just to make sure that they can do it. And anyway, they're also doing this in, was it intercepting every call, or it was all the metadata part of it applied to Mexico and the Philippines and Kenya, of course, which is involved in fighting America's proxy war in Somalia. Rest in peace, Somalia. And so anyway, then Greenwald says, oh yeah, and there's one more country that we're not naming. Because, I'm paraphrasing, I don't know his exact words, but something like the government convinced him that if he named this country, innocent people were going to be killed. And that there was a high enough chance of that, that he went ahead and went with that. Now, I don't know exactly how they convinced him. Eh. I think in principle, I'm against that kind of thing. Withholding that kind of information. However, I think that Assange probably went off kind of half-cocked, saying that, oh, I condemn you for daring to withhold this information. And anyway, I think the way Greenwald phrased it, innocent people didn't mean government employees. It meant innocent civilians in the country that would be named. But now Assange says he's going to name the country anyway. He knows which country it is, and he's going to name it, but then in 72 hours. So, however many, I guess 36 more, whatever it is. And anyway, I don't know. I think that Greenwald could be taking a step down a bad path here of acquiescing to government requests to keep information out. On the other hand, I think he's very conscious of that kind of thing. I know that his standard is very high, has to be very high. Just the other day, and this is, I guess, in his book, and it's in his interviews, where he attacks even the process by which the Washington Post, the New York Times, are used to calling the White House and saying, is this okay? You have any objections that we need to hear, or anything like that? And that they shouldn't even be doing that. That just, it helps write those helps enforce those unwritten rules, those norms, that basically the U.S. media is here to represent the U.S. government, is here to be their ombudsman to us, to explain what it is that they're doing to us in ways that we will ultimately find acceptable. And that's not what journalism is supposed to be, unless you're a government employee. But for the rest of us, it's not what it's supposed to be about at all. And he said he calls and he asks them for comment, and that's it. And then if they want to try and beg him to not run it, he'll listen to their plea. But I think, you know, he's trying to explain that he gives them very limited access to him to even try to plead that case. He's not like Bill Keller going to the White House and saying, okay, go ahead and line up all of your biggest stars and toughest, you know, apparatchiks and intimidate me the way Bill Keller did and then held the NSA story for a year in order to help George Bush safely get reelected. And anyway, so I tend to trust Greenwald's judgment on this, which I just saw somebody tweeting how that's reminiscent of Kevin Drum saying, I trust Obama's judgment over my own, which, boy, I sure don't mean to be saying that. And Glenn Greenwald is not a government official. Glenn Greenwald is a reporter and a damned good one. And and it's not trusting his judgment over my own. In my own judgment, if I was reporting this story and there was really a case, and I don't mean hypothetically, but really a case to be made that this name of this country will get innocent people killed tomorrow, that could be a problem. That's always a problem for reporters on the national security beat or on any, you know, very high level beat that, hey, people could get killed just as a consequence for being a source. You're messing around in dangerous territory like that. Ask Edward Snowden. That's what he told Barton Gellman. He said, you know, Barton Gellman, if they think that you and me are the only ones, or maybe they already have me, and they think you're the only other person on Earth with this file of information, they'll kill you. And I don't think he was playing, and I think that that was a pretty safe assumption. And I think that Edward Snowden did the right thing in including more reporters to make that impossible. And yes, I'm aware, and I think that Edward Snowden was aware at the time, that Barton Gellman is a very well-respected and established reporter at the Washington Post, and wrote not an unofficial, but not an official either, but a as critical as a Washington Post-type biography of Dick Cheney could possibly be. Story-breaking biography of Dick Cheney called Angler. Oh, that was his Secret Service code name. Anyway, he's a serious-ass journalist, and, you know, obviously on his beat, he knows a lot of people, you know, maybe who could help protect his life, but maybe not, you know. But I think Snowden recognized that this Gellman ain't nobody. He's not that easy to squash, but if it came to all they got to do to protect this information is kill him, would they do it? Yeah. Probably, maybe. So, it can be dangerous business, but anyway, I don't know. So, I think Greenwald, I'm willing to give Greenwald the benefit of the doubt on this. If this becomes a habit where all the time he's redacting information from his own articles because, oh, geez, they, you know, scared me with a ghost story, then I guess I'll begin to see it another way. But right now, I don't have any reason to believe that Glenn Greenwald would back down to anything but his own principle kicking in. That, like, no, I don't want to get anyone killed, and it's worth it to withhold it from this story because it's not the crux of the story anyway, and what have you. Hold it for now? Okay. But I don't think that he would just be intimidated by some BS by the state. Not at this point. Well, not ever. Remember, we all got a great laugh when the H.B. Gary documents show that, oh, yeah, we're going to threaten this guy Greenwald with his career and reputation and make him an offer of some money and stuff. And, oh, yeah, you're just going to corrupt the hell out of him, you guys. I guess you must have never written anything you wrote before then. That's what you think, you idiots. All right. So, all right. Anyway, so that's my Greenwald Sausage thing. Go read about it on Twitter if you want. And then, damn, man, I'm not even going to have time to talk about this. I don't know. Maybe we'll do a short interview with Pfeffer. I think he's in a hurry. So maybe we'll be able to get back to Libya. I sure was hoping to get Patrick Coburn on. Doesn't look like I'm going to hear from him. But there's a big doings going on in Libya right now. Looks like a CIA coup d'etat, possibly. Probably. The Marines have been moved. Extra Marines have been moved to Sicily. Perhaps preparing to go back to Tripoli, Thomas Jefferson style. Apparently, all my criticism of Barack Obama for being guilty of the highest treason for fighting a war on behalf of Ansar al-Sharia and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, veterans of al-Qaeda in Iraq, finally got through to him, and now he's decided he wants to back a secularist-type coup d'etat against the Islamists. And civil war is breaking out all over, and I don't know how long before the Marines are in the middle of it. But didn't I tell you this 3 years ago? I guess I'm happy to admit I didn't anticipate that it would take 3 years before it came to this. But you don't have to be an expert. You could be in kindergarten and know better than this. If they say they need a no-fly zone to protect the civilians of Benghazi from Gaddafi, then what they're saying is the citizens of eastern Libya will never be safe until Gaddafi is gone. And if they're saying that, then what they're saying is regime change in Tripoli. Come on, it's just one step. It's not even pre-algebra. It's just basic arithmetic, okay? Forget calculus, like all these idiot blowhard politicians and wonks like to talk about. This is basic math. Oh, we have to have a no-fly zone to protect the people. Yeah, in other words, there's going to be a regime change. And then what? When all the tribes go to war and all hell breaks loose and all the veterans of the Iraq war start doing suicide bombings and killing American ambassadors, then what are you going to do? At some point, you're going to have to try to create a nation state again in Libya. But who's going to do it? Who are you going to hire to do it? The Islamists? Are you going to try to create the next secularist Colonel Gaddafi? The next Field Marshal Sisi, like they have in Egypt. Like the American Empire has in Egypt right now. Anyway, more about that when we get back. And cops, too. Lots of cops.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at ScottHorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I've got John Pfeffer on the line. He's co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus. That's FPIF.org, put out by the Institute for Policy Studies. And they got a great stable of writers over there at Foreign Policy in Focus. Again, FPIF.org. And man, this thing is just bumming me out. The three war doctrine now. Well, geez, I thought the empire was finally downsizing a little bit. And it's now the era of the multipolar world. And the era of the unipolar benevolent hegemony was finally over, thank God. And things could be a bit more peaceful. But no, says you, John Pfeffer. Welcome back. How are you?
Doing good. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Very happy to have you here. Now, the two-front war doctrine, I don't know exactly how consistent that was held throughout the Cold War, but basically the idea was we ought to be able to fight in Europe and the Pacific at the same time, that kind of a thing. But now you're saying that now that we have no enemies at all, that we have to be able to fight a three-front war.
Yeah, it does sound rather paradoxical, but here's the situation. Basically, President Obama has declared his doctrine finally. He basically has said that the use of military force should be the last resort. We should do everything else possible first, diplomatically, with economic sanctions, before we even consider military force.
Which he doesn't really mean that, but anyway, for the sake of argument.
I mean, he has, of course, used military force in the past, and it hasn't been his last resort, but at least in theory, this is what his doctrine is. Now, that is a deeply unsettling doctrine for Congress, which is in the House of Representatives, which is in control of the Republican Party, and even members of his own Democratic Party. We should remember that Hillary Clinton, when she ran against Barack Obama, was always projecting herself as kind of the more realistic alternative, the one who was going to be much more hardline when it came to the use of military force. So there is certainly a faction within his own party that is uncomfortable with this assertion of this doctrine. Now, it comes at a time also of relative economic austerity. I mean, the Pentagon is still going to be basically at the same size this year and next year, but after 2015, at least according to current projections, we're looking at some reductions. Now, that too drives complete fear into the hearts of the militarists, who we might call members of the war party, which is not just one party or the other, but an amalgam of members of both parties who are committed to high military spending and the use of military force overseas. And they are gearing up for what will undoubtedly be an attack on Obama's foreign policy doctrine and his legacy. And that will be certainly part of the midterm elections, but I think it'll more prominently be part of the 2016 presidential elections. So what do I mean by the three fronts? Well, where we have seen the criticism of the war party so far has been in these three fronts. Number one, against a rising China. China has been more assertive in South China Sea and in other disputed territory around its perimeter, and there have been numerous criticisms of the Obama administration for not going up more heavily against China, particularly in the South China Sea. Number two, Russia, the old favorite of the Cold War. Putin, of course, has been more assertive in Ukraine, taking Crimea, making some noises about eastern part of Ukraine, maybe even some other territories in the near abroad that have large Russian-speaking or ethnic Russian minorities. And there, too, Obama has been heavily criticized for not sticking up for Ukraine more vehemently and going toe-to-toe with Russia. Number three, again, the favorite of the post-9/11 era, terrorism or non-state actors like al-Qaeda, but not just al-Qaeda, other forces like Boko Haram in Nigeria. And here again, the war party has said that Obama has not been strong enough, has not sent the troops in to get those girls back, has not gone toe-to-toe with all these non-state terrorist actors around the world. So what I anticipate for 2016 is a push by the war party to say, hey, it's not the time to reduce military spending. It's not the time to withdraw from the world. It's not even the time to focus just on one potential threat. We have three major fronts that we have to be fighting. The Obama administration blew it on all three, and our party, if it takes over Congress, takes over the White House, will not only boost military spending, but ensure that we are capable as a country to fight three wars simultaneously.
Mm. Well, now, it also seems like at this time, there's probably a bigger split on these questions between the people and the establishment than ever before in history. You know, the war in Afghanistan, which started out, you know, according to the official narrative, not like the Taliban didn't offer to give them up or anything, but started out as, you know, pure and simple revenge attack against those who had hit us on 9/11 kind of thing. You would think that that would be way high up on the list of justified wars in the minds of Americans, but it is now the least popular war in American history, less popular than Iraq, which people finally came to understand was really not revenge for 9/11 and was not justified in any sense in along those lines. Less popular than Vietnam, which killed, you know, somewhere around 3 or 4 million people and was much worse for the Americans. It's now the least popular war ever, and we saw Syria last summer. We see really the opinion polls about Ukraine along the same lines, and then the Big Pew surveys and the Reuters surveys and whatever, the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal polls, they all say that the Americans are sick and tired of this, and it doesn't really matter to us if the Kagans have an unlimited list of people that they want to kill. They can go kill them themselves. We're just not playing this anymore. I mean, you look at what happened with Syria, where it was 99-1 among the American people. That just forget it. No, you're forbidden from launching this war, Mr. President. That's absolutely unheard of in American history, right?
Absolutely. And as you point out, the polls are very clear on this. American appetite for military intervention overseas has dropped precipitously. And to a certain extent, you can say that this is the return, what I call the return of the industrial strength version of the Vietnam syndrome. In other words, the Vietnam War was such a palpable failure in people's minds in the mid to late 1970s that it applied across the board, that the failure in Vietnam suggested to people that the United States simply should not intervene militarily in any significant way overseas. On the other hand, if we look at the other two parallels in terms of history, where we had a Democratic Party president who more or less put forward a policy of a more prudent approach to military intervention. Certainly Jimmy Carter, in the wake of the Vietnam War and the overwhelming influence of the Vietnam War syndrome, and then Bill Clinton in the wake of the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union. At that time, too, as you were saying at the top of the hour, people were saying, finally, we're seeing the end of this aggressive American presence in the world. That changed. Changed in 1979. Geopolitical circumstances were part of it. It was the Iranian Revolution. It was the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, a number of other things, too, of course. And then the end of the Clinton years, and not the election of George W. Bush, but, of course, 9/11, triggered in another kind of wave of massive increase in U.S. military spending, and of course, another bout of amnesia with respect to the Vietnam War syndrome.
Well, just like Obama, under Carter and Clinton, there really wasn't much of a rollback, just the perception of one, the perception of wimpy Democrats not doing near enough killing, when really Carter gave the green light to Saddam, to the intervention in Afghanistan. And, of course, you know, Bill Clinton murdered 1 million Iraqis from the air and with his blockade for 8 years straight, et cetera, like that, bringing on the 9/11 attacks in the first place, really. But
exactly.
I understand what you mean about, you know, once the liberals are gone and the real men come back into power, right, all the soft-handed, pretend tough guys from the AEI, when they come to staff the Pentagon and the State Department, we all better run like hell.
Exactly. And so it's what we're looking at right now is the potential kind of repeat of 1979 and 2001 in 2016. Again, a perception that we had a weak Democratic president who didn't do enough to stand up to bullies, and a change in the geopolitical circumstances. And you can say right now, of course, the American public has no appetite for military intervention. But unfortunately, that can shift. It can shift if there's an incident on the scale of 9/11 or in the case of 1979, Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, that can shift American public opinion. If you have these two things combined, a shift in geopolitics and the return to the White House of the war party, then we may see this perfect storm of the three war doctrine basically imposed upon us.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, we don't have much time for this segment, John, but it seems worth bringing up here real quick about how we actually don't have any enemy states. China and Russia, they're not really enemies. They're sort of frenemies at worst, at least for now, we hope. And then Africa, they're not all satellite-type loyal client states. Not every militia there is loyal, but none of them are a threat to the U.S. in a million years. The only real threat to the American people, the only real enemies of the American people in the actual real world outside of these guys' schemes are the al-Qaeda militants who would hijack our planes and kill us with them or things along those lines. And yet everything that our government does makes their movement stronger. And that's where we're going to pick up this conversation on the other side is, you know, bin Laden's son saying he was so happy when George Bush and Dick Cheney got elected these pretend tough guys in their war party. They're going to be so easy to get to do what he wanted them to do. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm online with John Pfeffer. He's at FPIF.org. That's Foreign Policy in Focus, the Institute for Policy Studies there. Kind of progressive take on the empire, but very principled, very good stuff. So we're talking about the three-war doctrine. And, you know, what's going to happen when the Republicans come back in? None of this, I don't think, is a defense. I haven't heard John say anything that's really a defense of the Democrats. It's just sort of a warning that the Republicans, man, they're worse because they don't even have the pretense. They don't have a peace party within their ranks that they have to satisfy at all. The more they posture like tough guys, the better they do. And none of them are actual tough guys, which means that they're that much more dangerous since it's all, you know, a bunch of Richard Pearls playing out their bully victim fantasies on the world and that kind of thing. And we talked about, and you talked about before, you know, the three fronts that they're really concerned with that they are using as their reasons, their excuses for why the empire must continue building up to contain Russia, China, and then the pivot to Africa, the invasion of Africa as well. But so I wanted to go back to the Middle East for a second here, John, because I'm on the record as thinking the only way to solve the war on terrorism problem is to just knock it off. There's nothing you can do other than just quit and maybe let the European cops, you know, keep them away or something. Abolish the U.S. government. That's the best way to protect the American people from terrorism. That's my position. However, I am afraid that Patrick Coburn is absolutely right, that George Bush and Barack Obama, in effect, have conspired to create thousands of new Mujahideen from Iraq to Syria, all the way across North Africa, and even really down into Nigeria with Boko Haram palling around with the Libyan jihadists in Mali and all of that kind of thing. And that these guys, thousands of them now, more than bin Laden could have ever dreamed that he would have in his ranks, probably more than he realized he had succeeded in pushing on the world by the time he was killed, that they will serve as the excuse for the American empire to intervene in the Middle East for a long, long time to come. I mean, these are, by definition, these suicide bomber types are absolutely incorrigible. There is no possible negotiation with them. And so as long as the empire wants to fight in the Middle East, they can. Hell, right now they're backing them in Syria. They'll have a drone war against them in a year and a half.
It's absolutely true. I mean, and this is something that, of course, neither the Bush administration nor the Obama administration has fundamentally understood, which is how U.S. policies have encouraged the rise of extremists, have encouraged the rise of precisely those people that both administrations, at least formally, said they were against. Now, what's interesting here, of course, is that there you might actually find common cause between Washington, Beijing, Washington, and Moscow, because, of course, both Russia and China
and Iran, too.
And Iran have been both, they've all been on the record that they find, of course, Sunni extremism in the case of Iran, but any extremism from the point of view of Beijing and Moscow to be antithetical to their own interests. So here we might actually see, you know, some breakdown in terms of, and we saw that during the Bush administration. We saw actually quite close cooperation between Washington and Beijing, and some cooperation even between Washington and Moscow. But I'm afraid that, by and large, we're seeing a divergence in U.S. Geopolitical strategizing. Russia increasingly has been seen as somehow being the chief obstacle between the United States and Europe, kind of consolidating post-Cold War space in Eurasia. And China, of course, is the chief obstacle in the way of the United States obtaining the kind of economic benefits that it has long wanted to reap in the Pacific realm. Now, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is only the latest in the series of U.S. efforts to basically hitch a ride on the most successful kind of economic region of the world. China, of course, is a challenger in this regard. China wants to negotiate its own free trade agreements. It's it's going to be implemented very shortly, a new investment pact between China, South Korea, and Japan. So this I think, is what is at the core of the strategizing, not only of the Obama administration, but if we look ahead, what might replace the Obama administration. And I want to stress, it's not just the Republican Party. And even within the Republican Party, of course, you have a libertarian wing that is very uncomfortable with U.S. intervention overseas. Within the Democratic Party, of course, you have a wing that is even more skeptical of military intervention than it would seem the Obama folks are. But you also have a pretty hardline faction that we used to call Cold War liberalism, that basically was very strongly behind Cold War levels of spending and kind of Cold War intervention within the Democratic Party, and those folks still exist in some form or another. And we might see even Hillary Clinton representing that particular wing of the Democratic Party, basically running against, in some sense, what her predecessor, Obama, was standing for in terms of his doctrine, even if she was expressing in a more hardcore fashion some of the underlying or latent policies of the administration. So I don't see it necessarily as just the Republican Party necessarily taking over and then asserting these particular views. I could easily see the Democratic Party doing it as well, mm-hmm. again, asserting itself as no longer being a weak party, as expressing kind of the legacy of Harry Truman, et cetera, et cetera, and taking what are, generally speaking, much smaller geopolitical threats than al-Qaeda. I mean, we're not going to see Boko Haram, for instance, launching attack on the United States, but taking these particular non-state actors and raising them up in the same way that George W. Bush did when he asserted that al-Qaeda was essentially an expression of all the totalitarian movements of the 20th century. In other words, taking Osama bin Laden and raising him up in status from essentially an obscure threat located at the periphery into the expression of all the 20th century evils and everything that was antithetical to the American way.
Yeah, and in fact, I was talking with Eric Margulies earlier, even, and we were talking about the contemporary, thousands of jihadists in Syria now, and I was asking him, but even from the point of view of the Israelis, isn't it pretty dangerous and chaotic to have a bunch of al-Qaeda guys running around in Syria? Wouldn't they prefer to have Assad and the stability that comes with the Ba'athist government? And Margulies said, the al-Qaeda guys may be incorrigible, but they don't have a real tax base. They're not a real state. They don't have a real ability to wage any kind of war. They can do pinprick attacks, but not that are any actual threat to the Western states. And so, really, it's a no-brainer from their point of view that, yes, they would rather have lawless jihadistan on their northern border than the docile and compliant Assad, who hasn't made a peep about the Golan Heights this whole time. And so really, I guess at the end of the day, if you want to use, if jihadists are convenient to use for anti-Russian interests in Central Asia or in Syria or whatever, go ahead and redirect back toward Reagan's old Mujahideen. Why not? Even if they did knock down the towers. I mean, if you're an American politician, you don't care about that. Not really.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're going to see the use of these non-state actors for very instrumentalist ways. I mean, it's going to be a very serious situation. I mean, I think the battle, though, will largely be around the budget question, first and foremost. The question will be, really, can we as an American people afford to lower our defenses at this particular time when we're looking at Russia, China, and Africa. Again, granted that we're not interested in militarily intervening, but the issue will be, can we afford to lower our defense spending? And I'm afraid they're going to push very hard for us to continue to keep those military budget numbers very high.
All right. Thank you very much for your time. Great talk to you again, John.
Thanks a lot, Scott.
That's the great John Pfeffer, everybody. FPIF.org. Foreign Policy in Focus, the Three War Doctrine.
Hey, all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show, scotthorton.org, etc., etc. All right, next up is Michael Meharry from the 10th Amendment Center. Welcome back to the show. How the hell are you?
Hey, Scott, I'm doing great. How are you?
Good, good. Very happy to have you back on the show. Tell us the good news.
Hey, pretty exciting stuff in the fight against the NSA. Kind of quieted down over the last couple of or few weeks because most of the state legislative sessions have kind of died off and closed up for the summer. But several are still in session, and yesterday the California Senate passed the Fourth Amendment Protection Act, which would prohibit material support from the state to the NSA. And not only did they passed it overwhelmingly, 29-1. And so we'll move on to the House, and that's
29-1.
29-1.
World, how did you pull that off?
Hey, California, man. I think this shows the power of a bipartisan bill where you've got both of the sponsors, a Republican and a Democrat, engaged and working to get the bill passed. This is what happens. I mean, and really, how can you oppose stopping NSA spying, right? Unless you're a cop.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, unless you work at the telecom and that's your paycheck, or you work for the state and that's your paycheck. No, I'm with you. Well, man, I mean, that is just incredible. I guess, well, I have all this cognitive dissonance because I've never known democracy to work this well when it comes to people trying to tell the government to stop doing something. And I know that in this case, it's not telling the California government to stop doing something that they are doing. But maybe even more controversially, it's asking them to stand up to the federal government and say no to them. And this is the kind of thing that I'm just not used to seeing happen in America. And yet, it's almost... It's, I think, changed my mind about the possibility of the efficacy of
nice.
Participation in American politics. I'm much more just a call the score on the way to hell kind of guy, but what if Mike Meharry and them got a plan for how we could, you know, arrest our slide down this slippery slope? Maybe it's really not too late. Mike, what?
Well, you know, I look at it like this, and I'm kind of with you, too, on the whole... You know, the whole politics thing. In fact, we're having our primary elections here in Kentucky today, and you know, people keep giving me those, "Oh yeah, have you voted? Have you voted?" And you know, it's just so hard for me to endorse any of these people. But I look at this kind of action, like the California legislature took, and the action that we're pushing through the Off Now coalition. I look at it almost as institutionalized civil disobedience, if that makes any sense. You know, it's not passing the law. It's basically getting these legislators to stand up, like you said, to this federal bully and say, you know what, we're not going to do what you tell us to do because what you're telling us to do is wrong. And I think on an issue like this, when you're talking about, you know, spying on virtually everybody in the world, it's really, really difficult, and we were kind of joking about it a second ago, but it's a fact. Unless you are somehow drawing a paycheck from this, or you are part of the police state and you like having the power that it affords, your average person is absolutely against this. So I think that's the part of the dynamic that makes it work. This might not work on every issue. It might not work on any other issue. But when you have something that is so hideous and people look at it and say, this is so freaking ridiculous. We have this entity that's spying on us. Why wouldn't you stand up and say, hey, we're going to do whatever we can to make it stop? So, you know, I'm excited about it. I'm excited about the strides that we've taken with the Off Now Coalition this year. Even though we didn't get 20 bills passed, we've shined light on this issue. We've gotten some really good newspaper coverage of this issue, and we're getting it in people's mind that you can stand up, that you can face this bully and fight it, and that you don't have to just, you know, mindlessly submit. And I think that's an important mindset.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It's, you know, even without exactly succeeding, continuing the fight on as many fronts as possible and making it known to, you know, the rest of the people out there that, yeah, no, really, the consensus is against this, and we're with you, and you're with us, and here's what we can do about it, and never mind what TV says you're supposed to think about it. You know, you can see in front of your face, this is what your neighbors, this is what the American people really think about this. And so that comes, that's in terms of the lawsuits, that's in terms of, even if you can only get one house in 25 states to pass the damn thing, and you can't get it, you know, actually passed into law anywhere or whatever, just continuing that fight, having all of the different computer geniuses, you know, competing with each other to come up with the best new, you know, cryptographic technology and the kind of stuff that is very user-friendly so that regular non-computer geniuses like you and I can use, or you may be a computer genius, I sure as hell ain't.
No.
You know, these kinds of things, keeping the fight up on every single front, you know, if nothing else, it just shows what a fraud the Congress is and how what a waste of time it would be to rely on them. I mean, they need to see that politically speaking, they only have one choice, and that is to get good on this.
Exactly.
But to make them see that, I think we got to do it your way. I mean, this is what's happening here is you've got Republicans and Democrats in the state legislature in California who are saying, well, listen, I mean, what are we going to do? Cross these people when they're demanding this? We can't. We have to do it, right? Because, I mean,
exactly.
I'm not one to believe in, you know, politicians having souls or morals or principles or caring at all. They are doing this because you and the people that you're working with in this coalition are making them do the right thing.
That's exactly right. And, you know, you hit on something I think it's really important when you start mentioning that it gets people, you know, the computer folks and these other people engaged and active because it shines a light on this issue. And I think it's very important, you know, for people to understand that this to us isn't just a political movement. You're absolutely right in the fact that this is the kind of thing to make the real change. It has to happen on more than just a political level. It has to happen with individuals engaging in the system and doing things to be able to thwart what's going on. And, you know, Michael Bolden, the executive director at the 10th Amendment Center, and I were having a conversation about this when I was in L.A. a few weeks ago, and we were talking about the fact that the movements we're seeing that are being successful are ones where people in general can be defiant. And with the NSA thing, you know, at first I was like, well, how do you do that with NSA spying? He says, well, you know, it's getting people to start to change their online habits, and it's getting people to think about technologies that can maybe thwart this kind of spying. In fact, I saw this other day. There's a dude, and I can't remember where he is, but he has developed a series of masks, and he's basically made them out of his own face. You can buy these things and wear them, and they're real realistic looking, but basically they're designed to thwart the facial recognition software. So basically everybody would look like this dude. That's a great idea. I mean, there are ways that we can individually block and stop and avoid the NSA spying through the advancements of technology and through our own actions. And where you really see this is in the whole drug war and weed. I mean, part of the reason that the nullification of the federal marijuana laws is working is because you got a bunch of people out there that are basically saying, screw it, I'm going to use this for medication, I'm going to use it for recreation. And you get enough people doing this, and the law becomes very powerless in the face of masses of people just refusing to comply.
Right. Yeah, in fact, I've even read where judges have said that, you know, we don't even care if you have this kind of preponderance of the evidence showing that you're innocent and maybe should be set free, because at some point, the finality of the judicial process is so important that screw you, innocent guy, you got to stay in prison. That's how much their authority means to them. That, listen, we said you were guilty and we can't go back on that. Now, that's not usually the case. But anyway, I've seen cases like that. That's the terminology they use, the finality, yeah. Whatever. So in other words, I'm agreeing with you that they get really worried. It becomes very bad public relations when no matter how many people they put in prison, people and businesses and even states just absolutely defy their war on drugs and go ahead and do what they're going to do anyway. It brings the finality of their decisions quite into question in the minds of regular people everywhere. And so I think they very quickly then realize, oh, geez, we better really, you know, quit cracking down at least on grandma and the doctors and these kinds of things, because it's making us look bad and it's making them look heroic, you know?
Exactly. You know, I came up with this analogy the other day, and actually I wrote an article about it that'll probably publish over at the 10th Amendment Center at some point. But I was thinking about these big events like Mardi Gras. I've never been to Mardi Gras myself, but when I lived down in Florida, in Tampa, they have this thing called the Gasparilla Festival, and it's basically Mardi Gras with pirates. And you know, you get 100,000, 200,000, 250,000 people that come into downtown Tampa for this event. And, you know, everybody's got open containers of alcohol. You know, there's people smoking weed out in public. There's women flashing their breasts. There's all this stuff going on that if you did it on a normal Tuesday night in downtown Tampa, you'd end up in the Hillsborough County Jail. But when you have that many people down there that are down there with the express intent of breaking the law, the cops just stand there and watch. They're not going to try. You can't arrest 150,000 people that have an open container or cite them. It's absolutely impossible. The masses of people overwhelm the law. And it occurred to me that law is not really based on enforcement. It's really based on our consent. And when enough people begin to withdraw their consent, the law collapses on itself. And this is the kind of the concept of nullification. If you get 45 states, you know, 30 states that are saying, you know, we're not going to cooperate with you in NSA as long as you're operating in this manner. Well, at some point, that overwhelms the system itself. And that's kind of the whole principle behind nullification. Get enough people, get enough states that are refusing to comply and watch the law collapse on its own.
All right, when we get back from this break, we're going to talk more with Michael Meharry about how you can get involved and make this happen. We have a short window of opportunity here provided by Edward Snowden. We've got to get it done, y'all. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's the Scott Horton Show. And announcing not conflict of interest, you hear ads for the 10th Amendment Center and offnow.org on this show all along, but I'm just playing the ads because I like them. And I really believe in this stuff, so rest assured. You know, and it's true, and as you guys know, and I'm always full disclosure on here, I always explain, you know, CNI, that I run ads for Council for the National Interest and for the Future Freedom Foundation on this show, and I interview Phil Giraldi and Sheldon Richmond on this show, but it's not much of a conflict because, as you guys know, I'd be interviewing all these guys anyway. So as soon as you hear me contradicting my stated principles, then call me out. But for now, I think all my commercialism is perfectly kosher. The 10th Amendment Center, offnow.org, is their project. It's a coalition. It's not just them. It's a coalition working to nullify the National Security Agency's violation of the law, the real law, the Constitution that chartered the U.S. government in the first place, and the Fourth Amendment, which bans this kind of thing. And so I guess what I'd like to ask you, Michael Meharry from the 10th Amendment Center, offnow.org, to talk about now would be, first of all, the coalition involved in this, So it'll make people either feel good or feel bad about who they're joining up with, but I hope good. And then secondly, I would like to hear you talk about all of your various successes along these lines, the NSA project, and the partial successes count. I want to hear them. And then we'll talk about how people can really get involved and not just hear a commercial on the show every day or not just maybe fire off an email, but actually, I don't know, go meet with their congressman about this or whatever it is that you're recommending. There's all kind of resources here at offnow.org, and I want you to talk about all that too. So please, sir, the floor is yours.
Cool. Well, the coalition, you know, it's pretty cool because it's a multi-organization coalition that spans the political spectrum. The primary partner with this is the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, a great organization based in Washington, D.C., that focuses specifically on civil liberties issues, and they have been absolutely invaluable. And, you know, they're considered more, I guess, progressive. Antiwar.com is a coalition partner, Revolution Truth. We've got couple of state organizations, Libertas in Utah, We Texans, and obviously Texas, Occupy Eugene, Downsize DC is a coalition partner. So you can see we've got some folks that are on the left, we've got some folks on the right, we've got your libertarians, all working together with the singular goal of stopping NSA spying. And it's kind of cool because, you know, a lot of these folks, we may get together and if we had big, long conversations, we might disagree on more than we even agree with, but we work very well together as a team on this specific issue because we're all very passionate about it. And I think it goes to show that when you work together, you can accomplish stuff. And I wish more people would be able to set aside differences on certain issues so that they can actually accomplish something that's positive, and that's really what we're working to do.
Hey, listen, our opponents do that all the time, of course. They call it bipartisanship when they agree how badly to screw us, and this is just the,
exactly.
The other side of that is, you know, the coalitions of the opposed. We're against your wars. We're against your violations of our Bill of Rights. We're against the radical excesses of our state beyond its charter.
Exactly. It's exactly right. And, you know, this coalition came together in November of last year, so it hasn't even been a year. This was our first legislative session, and I think California is probably going to end up being the biggest success. This is the piece of legislation, as far as the big picture legislation, that's gone the farthest, and I am pretty confident that this is going to end up passing the assembly and get signed into law. I really am. I just see that momentum, so that's pretty exciting. We've also had some success on some bills that are more limited in nature that deal with data sharing and would specifically deal with warrantless data that's gathered and making it inadmissible in court. We had this law passed in Utah. It's been signed into law already, recently passed in Minnesota. In the state of Missouri, they're going to have a public vote in November in their general election to change their state constitution and make electronic data part of the span of things that are protected from searches and seizures. So it would specifically name electronic data along with papers and houses and all of the things that are already in there. So these are clear positive wins. I mentioned, too, just the light that's been shined upon this issue. You know, we have a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune in Utah that has kind of caught wind of what we're doing and got curious and did some reporting on the water contract that the city of Bluffdale, Utah, has with the NSA, and he revealed how the NSA got a sweetheart deal and how they're paying less for water than the average water customer there in
that
city.
Yeah, I read that.
Yeah. That would not have happened if we hadn't formed this coalition and started saying, hey, we're going to try to deal with this at the state and local level. Same dude got even more curious, did some public records requests, and forced the NSA to reveal exactly how much water they were using and how much they planned to use, something that they did not want to reveal. So we had a really good reporter that was working for Vice Magazine that has done some really good reporting on the tech companies and their opposition to any type of NSA reform and raised some really good questions there. So this is the first year. We look for this to move ahead. We expect more legislation to be introduced next year. We're also looking at, especially in Utah, where The bill was actually referred to what they call an interim study committee, so they didn't kill it. This summer, there's going to have to be at least one public hearing on this issue. I think it's going to get a lot of press. And we're planning on doing some activism-type stuff. We're working with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee folks and organizing grassroots people there that are going to do some rallies and raise that public consciousness. We have some plans in the work of doing some stuff to really shine the light on these tech companies and make them squirm a little bit for their support of NSA spying. So a lot of stuff that we look to happen going forward, but we definitely need help. We need people on the ground. We need people that are willing to kind of get their hands dirty and do some activism. And if you want to do that, you can go over to offnow.org, and there's a place that says get involved. And you click on it, and you'll just find some short things, questions that you can answer, and we'll get you plugged in your state and give you the tools and resources that you need to help move this ball forward, because this has to be, it has to be a movement of the people. It can't be a movement of politicians.
Well, now elaborate about that. What kind of thing are you talking about there? What they can do?
What you can do. Well,
or what you have them do when they click that. Yeah. What's the plan?
Main thing that we need people to do is we need people to take this piece of legislation, the Fourth Amendment Protection Act, and we need them to contact their state senator and their state representative and ask them to introduce this piece of legislation. In states where it's already been introduced, and there's actually maps on the thing, so you can actually click on your state and see what's going on in your state. In states where it's already been introduced and where it failed this year, talk to your state and local, your state senator and your state representative and say, hey, I want you to support this next year. That public pressure has got to be brought to bear. We also need people that are willing to help at the local level do things like write op-eds or organize rallies. Do these things on the ground within the specific states. You know, there's only so much that we can do from a national level. We need people organized on the ground in the state so that when legislation is introduced, they can actually organize people, make the phone calls, send the emails. It's not complicated work. It's just work that has to be done that you need people to do it. And,
right, and especially people who are already members of groups, you know, Iowans for this, that, or the other thing, whoever you are. People like that, they're already networked in, they already are interested in doing that kind of work, and they already can claim, I represent, my group is this many people, and we're a conservative group, and or we're a liberal group, and typically, you know, we're interested in these kind of issues, but by God on this, we're serious as hell, we want to see you do the right thing here, and, you know, for a society where most people really don't participate all that much, that kind of thing can be pretty impressive to some politicians about, you know, it might even give them a false impression that they really better get on board for this or else.
Well, you know, that's interesting you say that. I was talking to a state representative in Kentucky, and this has been a while back, but this really struck me. We were just talking about the impact of grassroots pressure. And he actually told me that he has gone through entire legislative sessions and never gotten one phone call or one email from a constituent on a specific issue. That just blew my mind. He said that very rarely do they get their constituents calling them and asking them to support specific pieces of legislation. Now imagine somebody that's in that environment, basically used to just kind of rolling around doing whatever they want to do, you know, kind of towing the party line or
right,
whatever.
And then here comes a riot.
Exactly. They get 100 phone calls or 67,000 emails. It does. It blows their mind. And they become very concerned because you hit the nail on the head. These guys, most of them, they're not going to do it for some moral position. They're not going to do it because they're great people. They're going to do it because they want to keep their job. They want to stay in office. Right. Or they want to move on to the next office. And if they think there's a bunch of people that might not vote for them if they don't do what they want, that's when they start to listen.
Offnow.org. That's where you find Michael Meharry and Michael Bolden and the 10th Amendment Center and the Off Now Coalition. Nullify the NSA. Thank you, Michael. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, man.
See you tomorrow, guys.